My next guest has been practicing emergency medicine for 15 years at the Johns Hopkins Medicine Sibley Memorial Hospital in Maryland, dealing with every life-threatening condition you can think of, like shock, massive bleeding, aneurysms, strokes, heart attacks, overdoses, and many others. And she has since been investigating how we can prevent these very conditions. And it starts when we're young. She talks about how diet doesn't work, how to prevent high blood pressure and heart disease, reducing our risk for cancer, and many other topics that she has explored and even created an online course for with studies she's collected. With that being said, Dr. Ritu Saluja Sharma, thank you so much for being on Changemakers Without Borders.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
It's really an honor. So, what really got you to start studying preventative medicine?
So as you said, I'm an ER doctor and I've been practicing for more than 15 years. And for much of that time, I was at Sibley, but I've been at a few other emergency rooms also. And everywhere that I go, you know, it's the same. People have the same struggles and the same medical problems. And so many of those medical problems are preventable. So, you know, it's sad. And I feel like being an ER doctor is a really wonderful job. And I feel like I've touched people's lives and helped them at the most vulnerable times in their lives. But sometimes it feels like we're just putting Band-Aids on. Someone has diabetes, we give them metformin. Someone has high blood pressure, we give them a blood pressure medicine. Someone has high cholesterol, we give them Lipitor. And then, you know, the down products of those medical conditions, you know, then people have heart attacks and strokes and, you know, cancers and all these, so many medical problems, and people come in suffering, and so much of it is preventable, not all of it, but so much of it. And so I feel passionate that that is not emphasized enough, and that really the way to truly heal people and to heal our healthcare system, which is overburdened with chronic disease, is to focus on disease prevention. And so that's what has really motivated me to do all of this.
Wow. So you just mentioned chronic disease. What is the factor that causes chronic disease in most of the cases that you see?
Yeah. So 80% of the healthcare spending in the US is due to chronic disease. And most of it, so many of those medical problems are tied to inflammation. And so this is something that has become extremely, it's just so interesting. And, you know, so many people are researching this, and there are, you know, just we're learning more and more how inflammation is the driver of so many of the issues that we have. So for example, heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. And those three conditions account for about 2/3 of our deaths. And all three of those are rooted in inflammation, chronic inflammation.
So what is the single most determining factor of our longevity? Because you talk a lot about longevity, health span versus lifespan. So what is the thing that can help us have a healthier health span?
So, so that's a really good question. So lifespan is really how long we live, and health span is how long we're living a healthy life. You know, so everybody's goal and dream, I think, is the same. It's we all want to live long and healthy lives, free of disease. We want to be able to, you know, do the things that we enjoy, to be with our family, to really, you know, not spend our years in the hospital and, you know, going to doctor's appointments all the time and unable to leave our house. So we really want to focus on increasing our health span. And so, you know, so I talk about this a lot. So really my program it's about preventing disease, and it's about losing weight, and it's about optimizing our physical and emotional health, but it's also all of these factors tie into how long of a life we live and how healthy of a life we live, like whether the last years of our life are spent, you know, in the hospital. So, So there's lots of factors. And so I think inflammation is a huge, that's really the driver of most of this. And there's a lot of different factors that contribute to inflammation. So, what we eat, our physical activity, our stress, our sleep, but then also our relationships. So there's been a study called the Harvard study is what people call it. And it really has looked at our longevity and, many different aspects of our life. And it has followed people since, I think, 1938. It started following teenagers. And so now, these people are in their 90s, and there's probably about 70 of them left, and they're still following them. And what they found is that relationships and having social connections was actually the single biggest driver of longevity. So it's not just what we eat and our physical activity. It's not just how much sleep we're getting. It's not just our stress. It's also our relationships. It's everything. So there's no one magic bullet of how to live a longer life, of longevity. It's all of those things combined.
Right. So there's also another study by Dean Ornish that showed that smoking is less of an issue than isolation and being, not being in connection or in any sort of meaningful relationship with others. So if you have, even if you're smoking, not that I'd suggest that, but you have meaningful relationships, this will actually help your longevity versus if you're living, with a great diet, by the book, according to the best medicine, but you have no meaningful relationship. You're alone all the time. And you have nobody to talk with, nobody to share your achievements, nobody to share your struggles with. That is the most difficult.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, so if I, in my program, one of the things that I talk about is the blue zones. And for those people that are not familiar, the blue zones are, it was a project that was started by National Geographic. And it initially, they started it by finding the five places in the world where people live the longest. And what's interesting is in all of these places, there's a lot of similarities in their diet, in their physical activity, in their routines. But one other similarity is that all of these places, people have social connections. And, the elderly people live with their family. There's, relationships between their grandparents and the grandkids, and people feel this sense of purpose. And those, that factor can, is so important. And, I think we can't really, forget about that and just only, focus on eating kale and broccoli, but really like relationships is could be more important.
So going, on this vein, pun intended, let's get into a little bit of relationships, because, you are a high powered individual. You're working in the ER for more than 15 years. You have two kids, you have a husband, you're dealing with, highly, stressful days, plus, keeping a family together. A lot of my audience, changemakers, Without Borders has changemakers themselves who are living high powered lives. What do you do in your relationship to keep it healthy?
I think gratitude is important, just making sure that I really appreciate my relationships and I make time for them. So I fully, I guess, appreciate, the support of my husband and the time that I get to spend with my kids. And I think that just making a point to remember those things and think about those things really, really helps because, my job is really stressful and I'm busy, but, you know, even taking like a little bit of time to just appreciate everything that I have, that really, you know, that helps me.
And do you go on date nights with your husband? Like, how do you make the time to keep your relationship going? Because you're not only working in the ER, you're also an entrepreneur creating those courses with all this research time involved.
Yeah. You know, not a lot of date nights since COVID, for sure. So, you know, but we do a lot of family stuff, you know, so on the weekends, you know, with the kids, we, you know, this weekend we're talking about going camping and, just, you know, just trying to spend a little bit of time together and just carve out that time to really, appreciate each other. And I think, you know, everybody's busy, but I think just taking a little bit of time and recognizing, you know, that you're taking that time for your family and really like being mindful of it and being in the moment, you know, not like, you know, turning off your cell phone and really trying to just be in the moment and spend time with your family. I think that like, even if it's not all day, every day, those moments, they're very impactful if you're mindful of them.
Definitely. And I like your point about keeping your phone away, because that even if you are with family, but you aren't actually there because you're on your phone, well, then that defeats the whole purpose. But mm-hmm. Ritu, what do you think is the connection between failing health and emotional pain?
So there is so much that it is so interconnected. I mean, there is so much that I can say about this, how our physical health and our emotional health are truly interconnected. And there's so many examples of this. So, you know, people with heart disease are more likely to have depression, and people with uncontrolled blood sugars are more likely to be depressed. And people with rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune condition, are more likely to have depression. And so, you know, a lot of these associations are still not completely understood, but we're starting to understand them more. And what we're finding is that a lot of it is linked to inflammation. So again, the same factors that are causing or, you know, contributing to our diabetes and our high blood pressure and obesity and heart disease are the same, some of the same triggers and same factors that are actually affecting our mental health. So, you know, there's something called neuroinflammation, which I think is like extremely fascinating. And basically, you know, so not only is inflammation affecting our bodies, but our inflammation is affecting our brains. And so things like Alzheimer's disease, so dementia or Parkinson's disease, MS, and even depression, they're, you know, we're learning more and more that inflammation in the brain is related to these conditions. Now, is it the cause? Am I saying that, you know, MS is caused by, you know, our diet? No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that things are related and that inflammation, the way that we're living and our, you know, all these factors, of what we're eating and our physical activity and our stress are all triggering inflammation. And that is making a difference in our brain.
So let's pause here for a second. I have quite a few questions about this, but first I would love if you could explain a bit about what is inflammation, because we hear that term quite a bit, but I don't know if we completely understand deeply what does it actually mean.
Yeah, sure. So there's acute inflammation, and that's like short-lived inflammation, and then there's chronic inflammation. And so inflammation, acute inflammation, that is a necessary part of, you know, of our health. So when we have an infection in our throat, our throat may become red and sore and our lymph nodes swell. And that is all our body reacting to an infection or damage to our cells. And then those cells trigger the release of chemicals like bradykinin, histamine, prostaglandins, and those chemicals then trigger our immune response. And that immune response then helps our body fight off infection and promotes healing. And so things like when we get a mosquito bite and, you know, so our body senses that. And so then we get a red, swollen, itchy bump. And that's inflammation. That's an acute inflammation. And that's our body reacting and healing. And that's absolutely essential. The problem is when inflammation becomes chronic and when the inflammatory response is triggered consistently. And that is what is the root of, or what seems to be the root of many of our most chronic diseases. And so things like our inflammatory Western diet. So all of the processed foods that we're eating, all of the foods that are really high in sugar, a lot of the saturated fat or trans fats, some of the, you know, a lot of the things that are really prevalent in our Western diet that we are consuming, that triggers inflammation. And then if we continue to eat those things day after day after day, you know, then the inflammatory response just is continuing. And that's what's chronic, that's what we call chronic inflammation. And so chronic inflammation is when, you know, that inflammatory response is not short-lived, but it becomes long-term. And then that ends up, you know, really being, instead of helping us, that's harming us. And that's the root of many diseases.
Right.
And so that inflammation, oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, so that inflammation, I use diet as an example, but, you know, our sedentary lifestyle, lack of sleep, stress,
yes,
you know, so many things. And then being lonely, as we talked about, you know, there are many triggers to inflammation. And then the other big one is our fat cells. So our obesity, so the food that we're eating is causing us to be obese, but then also our obesity is actually, our fat cells are also triggering inflammation. And this is something that I don't think that we knew 20 years ago. You know, we used to think that fat cells were just storage cells, storage containers, and they, you know, they just held fat. But now we know that those cells actually release chemicals, adipocytokines, so chemicals that trigger inflammation. So the more fat cells that we have, the more chronic inflammation. And, you know, if it's different than a mosquito bite, you know, where you have it and it goes away, those fat cells that are there day after day after day, and that are releasing these chemicals, that is not, that is, you know, part of what is making us so sick.
Do you see, though, athletes have inflammation as well?
Athletes?
Yeah, because they don't have as much. I mean, I'm trying to get at, like, what kind of things could trigger inflammation in different people, right? Because we have people that might have inflammation from, well, loneliness, or it could be from diet. It could be that you're obese. But if you're maybe eating very well and you are athletic, and is it possible to still have inflammation?
It is. I mean, I think that, again, it's like, there's so many things in our life. So, you know, I may be eating the perfect diet and exercising, but if I'm an athlete and I'm not sleeping, then, you know, that could be triggering inflammation. Or if I, you know, am under a lot of stress, then that could be triggering inflammation. So it really is looking at your life holistically and seeing what areas of your life that, you know, are, that you could improve on, that you can adjust. And I think for everyone, you know, nobody is perfect. And for everyone, there's things that we can work on to decrease the level of inflammation. I think if you look at the blue zones and those people that live these long lives, and all these people that live over 100 years old, and they're, you know, still walking and active, and they don't have a lot of medical problems. If you look at their life in general, a lot of the things that they're doing, it's not, you know, they're eating well, they're physically active, they're walking, they are socially connected, their stress levels are low, they're, you know, drinking a glass of red wine a day, but not like excessive, smoking or alcohol, and, or maybe a couple glasses of red wine, but still, if you're looking at those people there that are living the longest, they are kind of doing all of those things.
Now, I want to get back to the topic of relationships here for a moment, because we're talking about how, reducing stress levels, part of that could be relationships. I mean, if you're with the wrong person, that could be the number one factor for your cause of stress.
Totally agreed.
If you pick the wrong person, I mean, that's probably one of the biggest mistakes you can make. But it's very difficult to decide and to know also in advance, unless you do a long process of getting to know someone. But putting that aside for a moment, I know that a lot of couples have issues in even being together intimately. They're so stressed in their daily life that even making love as part of the fundamental things of having a good good functioning relationship, they have to drink or smoke marijuana in order to feel relaxed enough to be able to be together. So what do you think couples can do to be able to be together without needing those substances?
I think that there's a lot that you can do, things like therapy and, really like talking, expressing, being open and having clear communication, with your partner. That can be really helpful. I think things like stress, whether it's from work or whether it's from, financial difficulties, all of those things contribute too, so the outside stressors can contribute to stress within a relationship also. So I think it's really important to, to look at your life holistically and sort of think about all of the aspects of your life that may be contributing and then causing a strain with your personal life, because I think everything is interconnected. So, one of the things that I focus on for my program, so I have sort of two main emphases. So one is for individuals, and I help people make changes in their life that to help them prevent disease and to feel better. But I also, another emphasis is work in the workplace. I deal with like workplace wellness and burnout and stress. And, you may not think of those things as like related to your physical health or related to what you're eating or your physical activity or your sleep, but everything again is interconnected. So I think that like when we're talking about our relationships and issues within the relationship, I think that like, looking at your life holistically and sort of figuring out what things are causing stress and what changes you can make, that's a good way to start.
Oh, definitely. There, what you pointed out there is super important, to look at your finances, look at your, like how you deal with your life, with workplace burnout, all of those things really leach into other places in our personal life. It can really affect us if we don't work on it. You were also talking about epigenetics when we were talking personally. How does that come into the picture?
Yeah, so I love talking about this. And so epigenetics is basically, so you have your genes. Everyone is born with genes, but what we've learned is that your genes sometimes may or may not be turned on or off. And a lot of times what turns on and off your genes is your lifestyle or different factors. So epigenetics is really the study of, your genes and really what's turned on and off. And so things like diabetes, and I know so many of my patients, they feel like they are destined to be diabetic. You know, they'll say to me like, my parents are diabetic. Everyone's in my family is diabetic. Like, I'm going to be diabetic. And yes, there's a genetic component to that. But in actuality, those genes don't need to be turned on. And it's our lifestyle that often is what triggers that gene to be turned on. And so, you know, I think it's so important to understand that, because, you know, I think that, you know, for many of the many conditions, and we don't even, you know, again, so much of this is stuff that we don't know for sure, but like some autoimmune diseases, you know, it seems like many of these autoimmune diseases, they may have a genetic component, but then really like an epigenetic component that, you know, based on your lifestyle, these genes may be turned on and off. So something like rheumatoid arthritis, which I mentioned before. So, you know, it's believed that there may be a genetic component, but then smokers are more likely to develop rheumatoid arthritis. And that may be because by smoking, they are, the inflammation that they're creating is turning on this gene and then, you know, causing this disease. Now, again, we don't know this for sure, but more and more, it seems like this may be the case with so many of our diseases. So, you know, just what's in our genes is important, but equally important is what, or more important maybe, is our lifestyle and turning on and off those genes. And so if we are leading an anti-inflammatory life for as long as we can, you know, the chances are that those inflammatory genes and a lot of the genes for certain diseases, they may be turned off. And what's, I think, important to recognize is that our body is capable of healing itself. And so it's never too late to make these changes, because, you know, even when you're smoking, you know, you may be a smoker for years and years, but then if you decide to quit, within 10 years, your body has basically almost repaired itself for most people. And so that's the case for so many of these lifestyle changes, that if you, you know, you feel like, oh, wow, I've been doing all this stuff for 40 years and it's too late. Well, no, you can make changes and your body can still turn off genes, inflammatory genes. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, actually, epigenetics, even you were mentioning smoking, alcohol does histone modification for your DNA. So if you're drinking a lot of alcohol, it will change epigenetically the structure of your genes and will cause it to, I'm guessing, to be able to accept more alcohol without causing too much damage. But I'm guessing that the process of the histone modification causes damage in and of itself. What do you think about that?
I mean, I don't think it's completely understood. I think we're just learning all of these, you know, exactly what's happening at a cellular level and like, you know, and so I don't know that it's completely understood all of it, you know, and I think we know some of the pathways, but not all, but we do know that, you know, the bottom line is really just that our genes are not, everything is not predetermined for us. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're given a set of genes at birth, but what's turned on and off is often variable, and we have some control over those things. And that I think is very empowering to know that. So if somebody thinks that they are just destined to have certain medical problems, that may often not be true, and that we have control over our health. In many cases, we have control over our health, and we have control to prevent some diseases, and we have control to live a longer life. Because even so, there's something called inflammaging, and so basically, what people, scientists, and you know, everyone's trying to find ways to change the epigenetics, change our epigenetics to decrease inflammation and to increase our lifespan, right? But we know that the lifestyle factors, just the way what we eat and our physical activity and all these things that we're talking about, that actually has the capability to change these genes. So really, by like decreasing our inflammation, we can change our epigenetics, we can slow down the clock for aging. And so, everything is connected.
It is quite a breakthrough statement to think about it this way, that your life is not predetermined by your genetics. I mean, at least your physical health isn't, and it could be changed by your behavior. Dr. Ritu, do you think there is a point, or there is a space for, not only mindset for the way that it can change our health, but also, there are some people who believe in visualizations. Like if you read the Holographic Universe, you'd read that so many people, athletes who, did visualizations before their competitions and before their tryouts and everything, visualizing that, like the run, visualizing, them winning, the speed, everything that is related to that, related to success, they were much more likely to succeed in their athletic domain than the control group who just did their regular trials. Do you believe in that kind of thing, or where people visualize that they're, there's some cases where people reported that they visualize their teeth becoming straighter, their cancer tumor shrinking, and those kind of things actually translating into the real life?
You know, it's possible. I think that like our mindset is so important. That's one of the things that I really emphasize in my program and, for both individuals and for, employees and in the workplace, our mindset is key for really making changes to our lifestyle. And so one of the things that I talk about is that our thoughts will determine our feelings, and our feelings will determine our actions, and our actions often determine our results. And this is, I'm not the person who invented this. Like, this is something that many people, lots of coaches, life coaches, and, many people have written books about this. But basically our thoughts are really the driver of our actions and results ultimately. And so our mind really plays a huge part in everything that happens to us. And we are in control of our thoughts. Like, that is something that we have control of. So,
that we can get control of.
We can get control of. Yeah. So, I mean, that takes work. And I think it's not easy, but that is something that I think we can work towards. And the more that we work towards it and we identify that is actually, possible, and that our thoughts are controlling our feelings and our actions and our results, then it can change our lives. So I think our mindset and our thoughts is so critical for everything.
And this ties back to the epigenetics issue, where the thoughts can really determine what is open, what kind of genes are actually active and what aren't. Would you mind getting deeper into the studies of epigenetics and how our mindset can actually affect our genes?
I have to be honest, I'm not familiar with specific studies that I can say, this study, but I do think that that's possible, that our mindset and our thoughts can affect our genes. I don't know if that is completely proven or known as a fact, but I think it's definitely.
Oh, you were just cut out there.
It's
You were cut out for the last 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I don't know where do I pick up? Epigenetics and the mindset.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So what I was just going to say is I don't know of specific studies. That's not something I'm familiar with too much about, like our mindset and our thoughts determining our epigenetics. It's very possible that that is the case. But I know that our mindset and our thoughts, can really affect our actions and our results. And then, you know, if our mindset affects what we're eating and our stress and our physical activity and all of these other lifestyle factors, then that for sure affects our epigenetics too.
Oh yes. Yes, definitely. And there are studies that I know of that get into that with mice, actually, that show how the behaviors can really affect the genes. But that's something that's a very, very complex and deep subject. And let's get back into the reducing inflammation, which is another complex subject. I mean, I don't think science or medicine has completely been able to put the finger on how do we exactly deal with this. It's so ubiquitous. There's so many factors involved. And you were also,
yeah, I mean,
go ahead. No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think you cut it. You're asking. So, I mean, this is an evolving field of research. And so I think there's a lot more that we will learn, but you know, the question for a lot of these diseases, it's like, is inflammation the cause? So for autoimmune diseases, for instance, is inflammation the cause or the consequence of the disease? You know, it's not entirely clear, you know, how these things are related. And so I think, you know, and it may be a little bit of both, you know, it's really hard to know, but we do know that you know, our Western lifestyle is the driver of a lot of the inflammation in our lives. So again, what we eat, our sedentary lifestyle, and so even by exercising or increasing the physical activity in our lives, that can decrease the amount of inflammatory cytokines that in our body. By practicing mindfulness and decreasing our stress, that can decrease inflammation. And there's actually studies that show that mindfulness-based stress reductions can increase longevity. They have an effect on the telomeres in our DNA. So they have an effect on the cellular level to to slow down aging. Sleep, which we don't often emphasize in our Western culture, you know, everyone's trying to wake up super early. What time do you get up? And, you know, I don't need to sleep. Like, I'm so tough, you know, but if we're not sleeping, that is creating inflammation in our bodies. And so really prioritizing our sleep is a way to decrease inflammation. The relationships that we talked about, you know, of course. And so I think there's lots of things that we can do. I think it's ever evolving and we will learn more, but you know, so many of the factors that we know are an issue are, you know, just our Western lifestyle and our, you know, in our Western culture, and we have the power to make changes.
And what is
decrease our inflammation?
What is good sleep?
So 7 or 8 hours a night would be ideal for adults. And you know, if we think about, I mean, everyone, like in, you know, most of us, including me sometimes, and I'm trying not to do this, you know, sleep with our phone right by our bed. And, you know, last thing we do before we go to sleep is, you know, check our email and our texts. And then the first thing in the morning, we're looking at our phone, you know, but that, that stress, and, you know, that blue light from our phone and, you know, just, you know, we may not have as restful of sleep if we're, you know, constantly, you know, just stressed, you know, and maybe some people wake up in the middle of the night and they're looking at their phone. So really, like, ideally what we want to do is have like, 7 or 8 hours of good sleep. And where you're not waking up all the time. And when you're not like, you know, looking at your phone and, you know, stressed, you know, so, and I think that that's a area that we can work on for a lot of people. I mean, I that's definitely for all the people that I've talked to, for my clients and even for myself, that's been a big issue.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So as an ER doctor, that I think is like one of my biggest issues because my schedule is so crazy and I work till 2 a.m. and, you know, some days I would work all night. And so my sleep schedule was totally off. And that takes a toll. It takes a toll to, you know, if you're not getting enough sleep and, you know, even just establishing a routine where you're going to bed at the same time and you're waking up at the same time, even that makes a huge difference because, you know, our circadian rhythm, our body's natural clock, that's, you know, that's what our body is meant to do. And so, you know, trying to establish a regular routine, trying to make it restful sleep where we're not like thinking about work and looking at our phone and trying to get enough sleep, I think are important.
And how do we not damage our melatonin, right? Because melatonin is the strongest antioxidant in our body. And it is the thing that recharges it is sleep. And if we, like, you know, from what I know, you know, especially sometimes I also stay up at night working on the computer and my sleep is terrible that night. And I know that, you know, blue light affects melatonin.
Definitely. I'm so sorry. I keep interrupting you because it's like cutting out and I can't.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah, so I agree with you. And I think, you know, no one's perfect and, you know, life is life. And that's what I tell the people that I coach also, because, you know, I'm not expecting everyone that every single day they're going to eat perfectly, every single day they're going to exercise, every single day they're going to sleep perfectly. You know, that's not realistic. But and trying to recognize the importance of these aspects of our life and most of the time trying to go to bed at this, you know, around the same time and wake up at the same time. And most of the time trying not to keep your phone by your bed and trying not to work until late at night, you know, on your computer. That is probably not probably a good idea. It is a good idea. But you know, occasionally things are not going to work like that. And that's, you know, that happens. And there is melatonin supplements that you can take. And I always recommend that before people take supplements that they talk to their doctor, but, you know, for people that are traveling, for instance, and they, you know, they have jet lag and they know their sleep is going to be messed up and they, you know, their circadian rhythm is off, you know, something like melatonin, taking a small dose of melatonin, if you talk to your doctor and they say it's okay, you know, that can help you establish a good routine.
But if you take too much of it also, like, don't you develop some sort of, what is it called? Where it basically doesn't affect you any longer.
Yeah. Some tolerance, you know, it's possible. With melatonin, it's not habit forming like some of the other sleep medications. So that one is, you know, that's sort of in a different class than, you know, a lot of people are on prescription sleep aids. And so those things, you know, things like Ambien and, you know, some people take benzodiazepines like Ativan, you know, millions and millions of people are on these medications and they take them every night and they're very habit forming. And those medications, we don't know what the long-term effects of those are. So, you know, I'm not advocating that that people jump off of them. If your doctor puts you on them, you should talk to your doctor about weaning off, because you can't really like just jump off of those medications either. It's not safe. So before you make any changes to your medication, you need to talk to your doctor. But those, for many people, those medications are avoidable. You know, by making lifestyle changes, you can improve your sleep. So things like, you know, taking your computer out of your bedroom or not looking at your phone right before you go to sleep, things like taking a warm shower before you go to sleep, that actually can help. That can help because your body, when, you know, when you're trying to go to sleep, your body temperature actually drops, your core body temperature drops, and you, your blood is sort of goes to your extremities. And so if you take a shower, that kind of aids with that process. And so that's actually why that can help sleep. You know, watching your caffeine intake, watching your alcohol intake, which is actually can really affect people's sleep, making sure you're drinking enough fluids, making sure you're drinking enough water every day. That can actually amazingly really affect your sleep, because if you're dehydrated, then those natural shifts that I was talking about of, you know, the blood going to your extremities, that's, your body's less able to do that if you're dehydrated. You know, there's lots of things that you can do. Oh, exercise, you know, going outside, getting natural sunlight during the day and getting some exercise so that your body recognizes, okay, this is daytime, I'm in the sun, because your circadian rhythms are so linked to natural light. So making sure you're getting a little bit of natural light every day, which is going to help your vitamin D, but it's also going to help your sleep. So before turning to prescription sleep aids for a lot of people, if they try these lifestyle interventions first, then they could potentially not need them. And I think that, you know, because they're habit forming, we don't know the long-term effects, you know, it's worthwhile trying these lifestyle interventions that are not harmful at all.
Wow, Riju, that is so powerful. There are so many people I know that don't leave the house for days, even, especially since COVID. But you know, they're working from home, they're sleeping at home, they're working from home, they're eating at home, they're not even leaving their house to go for a walk. And so the sunlight might touch them, but if they're not beside a window in their office, they're not even getting those little rays of sunlight. And a lot of these people I know, they have terrible sleep.
Yeah. And that, you know, I think that's such an easy intervention. I mean, easy and not, you know, obviously like people need to, it would be a change of routine and, you know, they have to make time for it. So obviously, you know, any of these things, nothing is easy, but it's a doable intervention, you know, to go for a walk, by outside, by doing that, you're sort of, you know, killing two birds with one stone. I mean, you're really like also you're getting your physical activity. I don't like that analogy, killing two birds with one stone, but anyway, there's multiple ways that it's helpful in your life. You know, you're getting sunlight, you're getting vitamin D, you're getting physical activity, and it's going to help your sleep. So just one thing can make a huge difference.
And so another thing that you talk about is the microbiome. How is that all related to our physical health?
Oh yeah. So our microbiome is also so related to inflammation. Again, so the microbiome is our, you know, the trillions of bacteria that live on and inside of us. And these bacteria, probably are about like 3 to 5 pounds. So like the size or the weight of your brain. I mean, they are a huge part of us. And more we're finding out that our microbiome is really related to so much of what's going on in our body. So inflammation, our immune system. And so again, the foods that we eat are very much related to our microbiome. If we're eating foods that are processed, lots of refined sugars, that tends to, you know, make help the bad bacteria versus things with fiber and lots of beans and, you know, lots of fruits and vegetables. Those are good for the good bacteria. And those bacteria in your intestines, in your gut, that we're finding that may likely be related to asthma, allergies, potentially other diseases like maybe autoimmune diseases. I mean, there's so many things that we're finding that there are connections. And so we don't completely understand all of it, but we know that this bacteria and our microbiome is super important. So another thing is like antibiotics. So I have a lot of patients that, you know, they come in and they have a sore throat and they say, you know, I'm like, I want some antibiotics. I have a sinus infection. And most of those things are viral. And, you know, if we're giving people antibiotics unnecessarily, then that's really going to get rid of both good and bad bacteria in their body. And so not only will antibiotics not fix a cold, because most of these people, if they have a virus, the antibiotics are not going to do anything to shorten the length of that illness, but they may hurt the it will hurt the bacteria in your gut. And it may take years to go to replenish it and for it to go back to how it was, or it may never go back to how it was. So it's really important not to take antibiotics unnecessarily. And all these same things that we're talking about, you know, what we eat, our stress, you know, all of these things probably are related, definitely what we eat, but, you know, all of these other things also are probably related to our, you know, the health of our microbiome too.
And so in order to replenish the microbiome for it to be as healthy as possible, does non-organic food prevent that?
So organic versus non-organic is, that's a whole different subject. So, so organic food, you know, that is free of, it's non-GMO, so not genetically modified, and free of pesticides and, fertilizers, like chemical fertilizers and stuff that, and so definitely there are some people that believe, and it seems likely that, you know, that, or some people believe that that food could be healthier for us, that the that could be better for our microbiome. I don't know that that's completely established or known at this point. But it's definitely possible. And I've read some studies actually where it makes a good case for that. But definitely organic food, you know, by the fact that you're not ingesting these pesticides and toxins and, you know, that is really important for our health and then important for the health of our earth, obviously. You know, so I definitely advocate eating organic food. And I think, you know, it's amazing how much the health of our bodies is related to the health of our earth. And if we were eating the food that nature, you know, created for us, you know, more fruits and vegetables and less like potato chips and French fries, if we are eating the food more like what nature intended us to eat, that would make us healthier. But it also, if we farmed the way that nature intended us to, that would make the earth healthier. And that would also help our medical system, because then we wouldn't be as sick. And so I feel like the answer to all of these things is kind of the same. So, you know, if we're eating the food that nature intended us to eat, and we're eating organic food, not only would that help us, that would help the earth, that would help our healthcare system. It really just helps everything.
Wow. Dr. Ritu, it was a pleasure to have you on Changemakers Without Borders. I suggest people to check out Dr. Ritu Saluja Sharma's website. And also she has a online course there that goes into even deeper depths than we got to in this interview. And I'd love to have you back again to talk about more things in the future.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So this was Wonderful. You know, my goal is really to just get this message out and to really empower people, because I feel like, you know, even as a physician, I don't think I was aware, you know, for years of how preventable so many of our diseases are and how much we have control over our health and our longevity. And knowing that is very powerful. And so, so what I'm trying to do is really get this message out there and empower people with that knowledge, and then really help them make changes in their life to implement, you know, help them implement these changes and help them live a longer and healthier life. So that's my goal. And hopefully by doing that, that will ease the burden on our healthcare system. So that's what I'm trying to do. So you can go to my website. It's headhearthandsmd.com. And you can, you know, there it talks more about everything that I talked about, and the online course that I have that's part of my program really goes into all of this in much more detail and really talk about like specific diseases and how to prevent them and, you know, making all of these changes. There's just a lot of information.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much.